Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Ted, welcome back to 10% True. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
For the audience at home, I'm talking to... Actually, so Ted, I call you Ted and I call you Gabby, because Gabby was your call sign. You sign off your emails and things with Ted. What is the correct way of addressing you?
I sign both.
Okay.
Either one works. Gabby was my call sign just in the 4477. Monroe Watley tagged me with that. But so I go by either Gabby or Ted, but guys that know me in different squadrons call me different things.
Okay. I can't go wrong then. That's good to know.
No, you can.
So you've just indicated you were in the 4477th Red Eagles as part of Constant Peg, the exposure of foreign MiGs predominantly to the tactical air forces during the 1980s. And there's an interview that I did with you and Z-Man that's on the channel, which I'll link to in the description here. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about actually your arrival in the F-16 in the early days, 1981 or so, coming out of the F-4. And to understand a little bit about what the progression was in terms of your tactics development, how you learned to use the F-16 coming from the F-4. It was kind of interesting. I did an interview with a bunch of F-15E guys, which also I'll link to here in the video, where they talked a lot about how in the early days of the F-15E, which would have been 1980-89 or so, they just employed the F-15E like an F-4 because they didn't know any different. They were coming from the F-4 at Seymour. So tell us a little bit, Ted, about what you were doing in the F-4 at the time you moved to the F-16 and what the transition was like between those two aircraft.
Well, I'd been in the F-4 at Bentwaters from 72 to 76, and that was a three-mission squadron, primary air-to-ground nuke, secondary air-to-ground conventional, third air-to-air. So we did a little bit of everything. I went from there to Clark, 76 to 77, and we were a specialized air-to-air squadron, flying formed crews and formed elements every day, air-to-air every day. We did a thing for the Air Force called the Air Superiority Specialized Test. We had our own aggressor squadron right there. They serviced all of PACAF, but we had a lot of sorties with them since we were basically in the same wing with them. We had a WESSUP squadron for shooting missiles. So that was the air-to-air portion of Clark. Then I went to Homestead 78 to 81 as an F-4 instructor pilot. Coming out of Homestead, the DO basically asked me, he called me into his office one day and he said, "You're coming up for an assignment." I said, "Yes, sir." I was the assistant chief of wing weapons at Homestead. He said, "Interestingly enough for you," he says, "I've got an exchange tour with the Brits flying Harriers out of RAF Valley. Are you interested?" And I thought real long and hard for that. And I finally said, "No, sir. I think I'll pass on that if it's okay." He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want an F-16. He went, "Oh, man," he said, "let me see what I can do." So he finally worked me an F-16 to Nellis, and I got into the F-16 fairly early in 81. Hill had, as I recall, two operational squadrons and two RTU squadrons, and MacDill had three or four RTU squadrons, but Nellis was the first fully operational wing. So it was the best of assignments to get into that. Going back to what the Strike Eagle guys said, when we went into the F-16, we also kind of started with F-4 tactics. And it turns out the F-4 tactics weren't all that bad. It's just that the F-4, due to its radar and its maneuverability and things like that, wasn't able to do them nearly as well as the F-16 was. So going back to the F-4, a ground attack mission typically started with a low level followed by some type of delivery, either a nuclear delivery or a conventional delivery. And in F-16s, it was sort of going to be the same thing. So the low level in the F-4, the primary means of navigation was dead reckoning. It had an INS, but it wasn't a great INS. So this dead reckoning is you start at a known point, you take up a wind-corrected heading at a wind-corrected speed for a certain amount of time, and you'll be at your next point. And that worked great as long as there was nothing in your way, no mountains, no towns that you decided the last minute to go around, no aggressors jumping you where you have to maneuver against them, mess up the dead reckoning. In the F-16, the INSs were much better. You had an air-to-ground target designator box in your HUD sitting over the turn point. If it wasn't right on your turn point, which might be a road intersection, you could do a fire control computer SLU and SLU the TD box over onto it. And the fire control computer remembered that correction and applied it to all other turn points plus the target. You had a carrot in your HUD that showed you what speed to fly to get to that turn point on time. So all you had to do was match those up. And there was a mnemonic down in the lower left that said, if you're too damn lazy to fly the speed I'm asking you to fly, this is how much early or late you'll be at that turn point. So all the low level stuff was much, much easier. And if you had to do any maneuvering, you came out of it. The TD box was still on the turn point. The speed might be corrected to get you there on time. Correcting speed in an F-4 was a nightmare. As I recall, you had to do something like if you pushed it up 60 knots for 1 minute, you gain 6 seconds or something like that. Well, the F-16, the computer took care of all that for you. So then you get to the target area. And let's talk about conventional first. You had two primary modes of delivery. You had direct and you had dive toss. Now direct, you typically actioned at 3 to 4 miles and you did your pop up and you had your pull down, you had your apex and you rolled in on the target and you had to be at your exact dive angle, at your exact airspeed, pickle at your exact altitude with the exact wind corrected aim off distance and the pipper at the exact release point with pickle for the bomb to hit the target. That never happened. You were always either a little steep or a little shallow, a little fast or a little slow, little something else. And so you had to do some air analysis at the last minute. I'm going to pick a little high, I'm going to pick a little low, whatever. Didn't have to do that in the F-16. You just did your action point, rolled in, got close to where you wanted, put the aim off distance about where you wanted, rolled to the bomb fall line, went through the target, pulled that to the pipper, got up to the target in CCIP, which was our normal delivery mode as continuous computed impact point, and pushed the button, and that's where the bomb hit. We called it the death dot. You put the button, the pipper on the target and you push the button. To show you how accurate that was, when we would go to the range in the F-16 with TERS, triple ejector racks, and BDU-33s on the TERS, in the F-4, we didn't pay attention to which bomb was coming off which TER or whatever. We were just trying to get it somewhere in the 75 or 150-foot circle. In the F-16, the first bomb would come off the left TER and go straight down. And so we would aim about 2 or 3 meters right of the target. The second bomb came off the right TER and went straight down. So we would aim about 3 or 4 meters left of the target. The third bomb came off the left TER, left shoulder, and ejected left. So there we were aiming about 5 meters right of the target. The fourth bomb came off the right TER and ejected left, almost right under the belly of the airplane. So he aimed right at the target. The sixth bomb came off the left TER, right shoulder station. It ejected sort of under the bottom, so we aimed at the target. And the last bomb came off the right TER, right shoulder station, so we were aiming about 5 meters left of the target. And that's what you had to do in order to get bombs better than the rest of the guys in your flight. If you got a shack, which I forget if it was 3 meters or 5 meters, all that meant was you weren't going to lose money on that pass. You might not win it because there might be 2 or 3 guys in the flight also get shacks, but at least you wouldn't lose money on that pass. So that's how accurate the CCIP was. It also had the dive toss mode like the F4 had in it. But in the F4, you rolled in, you got the radar ranging. The radar was basically a bore sight. And so it's looking across the ground, and you get a pretty big radar return on the scope. The shallower the dive angle, the bigger the radar return. And the backseater would lock that up, but you could see the radar in there kind of breathing, trying to find the best spot in that radar return to give that range to the computer to release the bomb. When dive toss worked well, it worked better than direct did in an F4. But when dive toss didn't work well, it was much, much, much worse. And because of that, you basically never used it except to try to qualify with it when you had to qualify once a year with the thing. But it was just too unpredictable. Later on, the units that got paved spike got the laser and could use that laser to input the range to the computer. Dive toss worked much better. Dive toss worked very, very well in the F-16. But it wasn't as good as CCIP, so that's what we used. And it was excellent. So those were basically the same type tactics that the F-4 used, but done just much better and much more accurately. Let me talk about the radar in the F-16 just for a second. When you were coming in low level, I used to run 40-mile scope, 4-bar scan with the AX symbols at 20 miles. And when you put the AX symbols at a certain place, it would tell you the altitude that you were covering with that 4-bar radar beam. So an F-16 would cover 23,000 feet of altitude. So typically, I'd look from about 3,000 below me to 20,000 above me, and I'd have the wingman looking 20,000 above to 40,000, 43,000 above us. So we're covering an area out in front of us, 60 degrees on either side, 40,000 feet of altitude out at 20 miles. And typically our radar contacts would be 25 or 30 miles of most fighter sized targets. So the radar gave you a very good picture of that in the F-16. In the F-4, not so much. You know, you're looking up, there might be some clouds that might give some ground returns. There were things called stays, second time around echoes, where the radar would go out and it would listen for ones coming back, but some of the radar energy would keep coming out and it would come back to the receiver the second time around and just put a couple little flecks on your scope that only stayed there for one sweep and then they were gone. And the backseaters were back there, you know, they had to manually tilt the radar and gain it up and down a little bit too much. They gained down or not enough, they gain up. And it was just a real difficult thing to do with that F-4 radar, even looking up. And if you had to look down with that F-4 radar into ground return with cities and towns and ridgelines and this and that and something else, trying to pick a moving target out of that was a nightmare. Whereas with the pulse Doppler radar, the only thing that showed up, excuse me, was the moving targets. So the systems and everything were much better. The accuracy was much better. So it allowed us to do a lot of the things that we did in F4s, but did them much better.
Can I ask then about, so a couple of obvious questions are going from two seat to single seat fighter. You've actually just addressed some of the questions that I would have had around that in terms of, I guess, the sort of automation or the capability of the systems meant that that second person wasn't as necessary as required. Did you feel the loss, if that's not the wrong way to put it, of having a backseater? I mean, you know, two pairs of eyes are better than one. The ability to, you know, create additional situational awareness. I know that some backseaters can suck the SA out of you. I know that works the other way too. But what was your feeling about that?
There is benefit to a second set of eyes. There's no doubt about that. Part of the way the F-16 made up for that was an F-4, you could turn around and if you push your head against the side of the canopy, you could see back maybe, oh, I don't know, to within maybe 30 degrees of your tail. So you could turn around 150 degrees maybe and look. In the F-16, you could turn around right and see your left wing tip. And vice versa. I mean, you could just look right down the airplane. So it was distracting to do that, but you did have the capability to find guys that might have gotten behind you. the calm between a front and a back seater in an F4, crew coordination and knowing what to do was just very critical. And being able to pass information in short, easily understood bursts. Now, if you didn't have that, you had the front seater and the back seater talking back and forth a good bit together. Then you had radio coming in from the flight lead or the wingman coming in to you. Then you had the tone and the headset for angle of attack in the F4. Beep, 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 beep. And if you add into that either AWACS or GCI, your hearing is just task saturated to where you can't hardly hear any of it. So one of the good fixes for that was when we were Clark, we flew form crew, formed element. Drake, Bradley, Martin, and Yauch, we flew together all the time. So we got pretty good at being able to pass information back and forth in very short, concise statements that everybody understood. In the F-16, you didn't have that chatter. So you had to make up for the backseater some way. And one of the ways for the 6 o'clock coverage was you could see. The radar coverage was you didn't need to tilt and gain. You could set it. It covered a big expanse of space. In the visual arena, trying to lock up with an F4 was very difficult. We had normally the radar swept relative to the horizon, but there was a mode called stab out, where then if the wings were like this, instead of sweeping relative to the horizon, it would sweep relative to your wings. But then you're talking to this guy, you know, on the nose, 30 high. So he's got to run the thing up 30 high. And by that time, the guy might be 40 high or something. So that was very difficult to get radar lock-ons, except for bore sight. If you could put him in the pipper and bore sight him, then you could get the lock. But that was about the best F4 lock in a maneuvering environment. F-16, much different. You had four auto lock-on modes. You had the first mode, which was a 20 by 20, which basically locked anything in the HUD field of view. If there were more than one plane in the HUD field of view, you could pick the one out you wanted. You would target designate switch forward, which brought the radar into bore sight right on the gun cross, put that on and release it, and it locked him, and you knew it was locked to him because the target designator box was around him and not the other guy. If you were in a turn and fight and the guy was 30 or 40 high, you went to vertical scan. And it scanned 10 by 40 or 50 this way, it would lock him up that way. Or we had what we called slewable ACM, which I think the F-15s call auto guns, which brings up a 20 by 60 scan, four bar scan, that initially comes up directly centered on you, 10 above, 10 below, 30 right, 30 left, but you can move that any place you want. So if you're out in front of a fight, but you want to come back into it, you can just put that thing level off to your left side, bring it back around in a 8G turn or whatever you're going to do, and the radar will lock him and put a TD box on him, and you can uncage the missile and stuff him very fast. So the systems on that compensated for not having a WISO in most of the situations.
What was the, and there's a lot to go through in the things you're talking about, but one question I wanted to get in before I forget it, if I'm honest with you, is to understand a little bit about what was the intended employment method or approach for the F-16. One of the things that's noteworthy about it is that it was designed with no medium range missile capability. I know that the air defense units had stuck the AIM-7 on it, but you guys would have gone out the door presumably just with AIM-9. What use I don't know, it's maybe being argumentative to say what use is a 40-mile radar, radar scope or whatever, if you've only got a sort of, 4 or 5 mile missile, in the form of the AIM-9.
It was originally designed as a lightweight fighter. Now you have to remember the F-15 was in front of this, but it was only in front of it by about 7 or 8 years. And they wanted, there were some in Congress that wanted the F-15 to also be a bomber. And the F-15 guys, the people in Congress didn't understand that when you start adding things for bombing, you're adding weight, which is detracting from your air-to-air performance. So the F-15 mantra was not a pound for air-to-ground. And part of this selling this F-15 as the pure air-to-air fighter meant that the F-16 had to be designated more as the pure air-to-ground fighter. At least initially. That got the F-15 money to continue on. The AIM-9Ls were just coming into existence, So that gave us front quarter capability. AIM-9J would have been almost worthless. But that's why initially the airplane didn't have long-range missiles on it. That and the fact that an AIM-7 weighs 500 pounds. It's not a small missile. An AIM-9 weighs, I think, 167 pounds, significantly smaller. Some people called it the bottle rocket because it kind of just popped off when it shot, but it had good results. And I think the AMRAMs weigh about 350, if I'm not mistaken. So losing 150 pounds of missile brought the F-16s much better into the long-range radar missile arena.
Can we talk a little bit more about the radar then, sort of having established that sort of background then? I suppose there's a natural comparison with the F-15 in terms of technology and capability. I don't really know anything about that early radar for the F-16. I know a little bit about the early APG-63 for the F-15 in terms of it having similar, you know, sort of the acquisition curses, the, you know, showing what the radar coverage is, and a lot of interpretation and simplification so that it just gave you, the pilot, the ability to make a decision around how you're going to effectively run the engagement rather than trying to figure out what was happening. Did you have the same sorts of capabilities then in that early F-16 radar? But what was your view of the radar then? Did you look at this and think this is a quantum shift in capability? Did you look at it and think, I don't really trust it? Did you, what were your impressions of it?
Oh no, it was a quantum leap in capability. They took the F-15 system. When you determine beam width is a trade-off. If you take your power and put it in a smaller beam width, it can see out further, but you don't cover as much altitude. So the F-15 had a fairly small beam width. And as I recall, they had an 8-bar scan. So it took them 8 bars to go through this whole thing if they used their 8-bar scan. This is my understanding of their radar. Ours, I think they consciously determined 8-bar scan was a little much. And since we didn't have any long-range radars that were going to be shooting out at 30 miles or even 20 miles, any missiles, they increased the beam width. So now we covered about the same amount of sky as an F-15 covers. We covered it in 4-bar, what they covered in 8-bar. And the price we paid was our detection range was decreased. But it was still a wonderful radar. One of the things they had in it was great was a thing called target histories. So I think you could run like 1, 2, 3, or 4 target histories. I used to run target history 3. What that meant was you'd get a hit on the radar, and the next sweep, it would update him, but it would keep that last target on there. And the next week, we would update him again, but keep his last 2 on there. So you could kind of see which direction that he was drifting and things like that without ever locking up or anything like that. So the radar was very reliable. It almost never failed. The airplane had a thing in it called a maintenance fault list. It also had a pilot fault list. And so if anything was going on with the radar or any other system, it went into this maintenance fault list. And at the end of the flight, maintenance pulled this thing out of the computer and it said, the radar had a peak power detect 2 times. Let's tweak that a little bit. And they did a lot of preventive maintenance that hadn't showed up yet to the pilot before it ever showed up.
We're going to, hopefully we'll have time to talk towards the end about your thoughts moving from, so you flew the F-16A and then you went to the Red Eagles and then you went to Luke and flew the F-16C and hopefully we'll get a comparison between, you know, those two versions and how they had changed. But that radar then, did it have lots of modes? Did it have, a raid mode, a twiz mode? What did it have?
It had more modes than you could learn to use. For example, I've already talked about the air-to-air mode, which basically was range while search was its normal mode. It had the dogfight modes with 4 modes under that. Air-to-ground modes, it had map modes. It had the offset aim points, 2 offset aim points for a target. It had expand where you could blow it up and get a better picture of it. It had a thing called DBS, which was Doppler beam sharpening, which typically worked best if a target was like 15 degrees off the nose. And it would paint things in such detail. It was a little grainy, a little digitally, but you could paint the back 12 cables going across the runway with that thing in Doppler beam sharpening. It had ground moving target track modes with notches at 3 knots and 5 knots, where you could track target. I tracked a Winnebago camper going up the side of a hill one day outside of Phoenix. I'm not sure the A model had that. That might have been a C model mode. But it had like C1 and C2 for finding ships in low sea states and high sea states. It had a good many radar modes, but the A model mode did not have, A model radar did not have track while scan. It did not, which the C model did. It did not have non-cooperative target recognition, which the C model had. It did not have raid cluster resolution, which the C model had. So the C model, which just came out about 6 or 7 years after the A, it was another quantum leap forward.
What about then maneuverability? The other very obvious thing about the F-16 is the 9G capability, the reclined seat. You're going from the F-4, which I know was, you know, loved by many, but maybe wasn't the best turning fighter. What sort of adjustments did you have to make? Did you have a program or a process where you built up to pulling 9Gs, or did you just go straight from the F-4 into the F-16 and do whatever you wanted?
You went straight from the F-4 into the F-16 because nobody really knew that much about what was going to happen. F-16 was extremely maneuverable. A clean A model was unbeatable in a visual fight. And I know the F-15 and the F-18 guys are going to moan and groan about that, but it was the truth. That thing was just a beast. It could do double M moments. You'd start at 450, 500 knots, do one M moment, still have 300 knots, do another M moment. So they couldn't outclimb you. They couldn't outturn you. You didn't have to worry about over G in the plane because the computer took care of that. So an F-15 had to blend his Gs in slowly and control them. And the F-16, you could just go, give me 9. And as much as I don't like to admit it now, some basic fighter maneuvering in the visual fight came down to just two things: throttle AB, stick full aft and hold. And hold it there till the airplane turned around and got behind him, and then uncage the missile and shoot, or go to guns. So it was maneuverability was beyond anything that we'd ever imagined. You got to the point where you realized you had to be in fairly good shape to sustain these Gs. 9 Gs is hard to do. I mean, that G suit is cutting you in half. You have to ease off occasionally just so you can breathe. The reclined seat was meant to do two things, really. One, it reduced the distance between your brain and your heart so that the heart didn't have to pump blood quite as far up to keep it in your brain. But it also lowered the profile of the canopy just a little bit. So it was kind of a twofer. But the thing was, you're leaning back in this seat and you don't fly offensive BFM like this. You fly it like this. So you got a 30-degree seat. What amounts to is you've got a 30-degree bend at your 6-7 cervical vertebrae. And a lot of guys had to have neck surgeries because of that. So you had to basically go to the gym. You had to lift some weights. You had to do some running. And you had to do neck exercises. They had to, you know, do 10 of these and 10 to the back and 10 to the side and 10 to the front, trying to build up your neck muscles. The hardest fight you ever had in an F-16 was a similar fight against another F-16. I mean, it was just a G-pulling contest to see who could sustain the most Gs for the longest period of time. If you were defensive, your head typically flopped back against the seat, and my arm was stronger than my neck muscles. If I wanted my head to move left, I'd grab my oxygen mask with my left hand, and I'd pull my head over that way, and my head would then be trapped. And I could look behind me and fly the defensive BFM. If there was ever a reversal, I'd grab the oxygen mask and I'd push it over to the right. So my head was over there looking right. At 8 or 9 Gs, everything weighs more. Your head weighs more and your blood weighs more. Everything weighs more. And it was a thing that you needed to be in better shape to fly that F-16. It had the clean A model. as I said, was just, it was the most maneuverable thing I've ever flown. But then two things happened where they took some of that maneuverability away from us. First was, if the generator, it was an electric jet. It needed electrics to fly. And the things that really needed electrics to fly were the flight control computers. There were four of them. If the generator dropped offline, emergency power unit came online to provide electrics for the airplane. This was in the early days. Later on, they changed a lot of the electrics. The emergency power unit had a primary and a standby speed controller on it to keep it from overspeeding. But in the early days, neither one of those were working very well or as well as they should have. And the emergency power unit was coming on and was overspeeding, which was putting an overvoltage into the flight control computers. The A computer, which was the master, would detect this and just say, I can't take this voltage. You're going to burn the computers up. And it would shut down inputs to the flight control computers. Now, if your yaw channel goes to zero, your rudder centers and not much happens. If your roll channel goes to zero, your aileron center, and you're going to crash eventually, but probably not in the next 3 or 4 seconds. But if that horizontal stabilizer goes to neutral, depending upon the speed, you're going to crash right away. And this is going to be impossible to see, but the speed curve, the way it was, it would go way down, and then it would jump way up, and then it would kind of flatten. And where we were running around in our speed was right around up here, where if that horizontal stabilator went to neutral, you got like minus 10 negative Gs. Hope the guy doesn't mind using his name, but there was a guy named John Carey who was going into Buckley one day, and his generator fails. The emergency power unit comes online. It overspeeds. Everything goes to neutral. He gets this big minus negative G's. His shoulders are up against the canopy. He can't reach the ejection handle. It does an outside Immelmann, but the negative G, negative angle of attack, bled so much airspeed down. He's now down in that positive G area. It pendulums back down. I think he was like 90 nose down with 2,000 or 3,000 feet to go. He pulls the handle, never figuring he's going to get out, but wanted everyone to know that he didn't give up. He tried to the very end, and he wanted to die outside the airplane. He got 2 or 3 swings in the chute and hit the ground. John's face was black and blue from all the blood that had gone up to his head while he was under these negative Gs. But he got out of it. A couple months later, there was a guy up at Hill. I won't use his name. He was on the range. General Dynamics was out there with film crews filming it, and he experiences this same thing, and they watch his airplane start flying like this. And he wasn't able to, he did eventually, I think, get to the handle, but either he didn't clear the plane or he just barely cleared the plane and didn't get a full chute, and he died. So that grounded the airplanes. Two things came out of that. One, they put a third speed controller on the emergency power unit, but two, they said, if we take away a degree and a half of horizontal stabilator authority from them, then that will shift this graph to where they're normally running around and they're up here in the area that's minus 10 negative Gs. Now they'll be down here in the area where they're positive 10 Gs, and at least they can reach the ejection handle. So that took away some of our maneuverability. The next thing that happened was the leading edge flap program was a very aggressive program to give it the very aggressive maneuverability the plane had. It was so aggressive that on a couple airplanes, the torque tube that was controlling these leading edge flaps broke, and the flap just went straight up in the air on the leading edge of the wing. I don't remember if we lost a plane because of that, or if we almost lost a plane or two because of that, but the result was they softened that leading edge flap program, and that, again, took some of our maneuverability away. Still a great airplane, but now we're sort of equal to an F-15A. And then, of course, later on when they went to the C model, they added about 2,000 pounds to it to accommodate the lantern pods, and that, again, took away some of the performance. Still a great maneuvering airplane.
Did you always have, is it 27 degrees AOA limit? Did you always have that?
I thought it was 25 degrees.
You're probably right. I'm just trying to, I only know it from...
Yeah, it did. And it would take you, if you were in a hard turn at 9 Gs, it would keep you at 9 Gs as the airspeed bled down, it would take you to 25 degrees angle of attack, and it would hold you there. there were certain things you couldn't do because of that. You couldn't, like in the F4, we would teach stalls, you know, landing configuration stalls, where you get the airspeed down, you get the buff, and you have to recover. In F-16, you couldn't do that. You had to power it idle after the gear down and stuff. At level flight, it would, the angle of attack would increase, so it got to 25 degrees angle of attack, and then it would put you in a 700 to 800 foot per minute rate of descent at 25 degrees angle of attack. So it was, that was always there.
What about G-lock then? So G-lock presumably was a thing before the F-16. I mean, you can G-lock at 3 Gs, can't you? If you're tired, dehydrated, you know, if you don't do, I think there was a Red Arrows pilot who G-locked, and he did it in the circuit to land. I think it was a 5G break or something like that. G-locked and unfortunately didn't get out of the airplane, so it killed him.
Was he wearing a G-suit?
Yeah, he was, but he was tired. I think the accident investigation said he had flown several times in the last few days. This was his second display of the day, and maybe he just didn't strain. Went into the brake to land and didn't strain or something. I don't know. I mean, you know, there were some extenuating circumstances by the sounds of it. But at any rate, you must have known about G-lock. But did the incidence rate of G-lock go up with that 9G capability? Were people smart enough just to let off the G's a bit if they started to lose it?
It went way up. I had never really even heard of G-lock before the F-16. And as a matter of fact, when I went into the F-16 the first time, you didn't have to go to centrifuge school or anything else. You just went from your airplane, you went to the F-16, and you started RTU. The first incidence that I know of G-lock was up at Hill in RTU. There was a student in the front seat, an instructor pilot in the back seat. And during this thing, the student G-locks, G-induced loss of consciousness, where basically, I guess your audience understands about the blood draining from your brain and tunnel vision and things like that. The brain, if it's got about 4 to 5 seconds of oxygen in it, it can work fine with no oxygen for 4 to 5 seconds. But when you exceed that, then it just shuts down immediately. There's no warning. There's nothing else. You're fine. The next second, you're unconscious. This student G-locked, the back seater knows the airplane's going down, tells him to recover. When the student doesn't, then the backseater takes control of it and recovers the airplane. And it wasn't until later they figured out what had happened to him. And the thing about G-lock is when you ease off the G and you get blood back to your brain, you're still not functional for like 20 or 30 seconds after that. I mean, the neurons are kind of firing and your hands are moving, but you're not really able to control them to say, okay, now I'm going to fly an airplane with them. So that happened. And then we started going into some training for this, a little bit of the weight training and a little bit of running, but they didn't want you to run too much because running too much lowers your blood pressure. You know, they wanted you to be able to get your blood pressure up, which is what a straining maneuver does. If you're raising your blood pressure to try to keep that blood in your brain so you can still function and see. Then there were two cases. I won't mention these guys' names either, but there was a weapons school instructor, and he had been, I think, sick for a couple days and came back and went out on an air-to-air mission and apparently G-locked and died. And then there was a guy in my old squadron at Nellis, the 429th, who went out on an air-to-air mission, G-locked and died. And so then we started doing, you know, some G-awareness turns, build 4 to 5 Gs, building up to it so you could understand what it was. And the biggest thing is honoring that tunnel vision and blackout. Because like I said, the F-16, you can just go, give me 9. And it'll take you from 1, it'll actually take you up to 9.4. It had a 5% allowable overshoot. It'd take you to 9.4, and then it'd bring you back down, 9.3, 9.2, 9.1, 9.0, and it just holds you there.
Can you, because the audience is going to be aware of G-lock and what it is, but they may not be aware of what it feels like. Can you describe the stages of, you know, the increase, well, the loss of vision, the increase in sort of perception around audio, and then you know, give them a sense of what it's like?
Well, I can give you a sense of what it's like as much as I've experienced it. You know, every fighter pilot's ever flown, as you're pulling G's, you've got a G suit on, and in my years it was bladder and lower legs, and that starts inflating with air to keep pressure on those things so the blood won't go down there and pool. And you're doing this straining maneuver, increasing your blood pressure, trying to keep blood up to your head and your eyes. Your eyes have fluid in them, which is under pressure. And for blood to get oxygen to your eyes, it's got to be more pressure than is required to get it to your brain. So the result of that is, if you're pulling too much G, the indication that you're pulling a lot of G is the first thing that happens is you start to lose your peripheral vision, tunnel vision. You can still see in the center, but you're losing the outside of it. If you keep pulling, you will go to blackout. Now, blackout isn't unconsciousness, it's just you can't see at all. You're perfectly conscious. So you got to ask yourself at that point, what good am I doing if I can't see? I got to at least be able to see a little bit. So most people then ease off the G to where you can start getting your vision back and then fly from there. If you keep pulling after the blackout, at some point you're going to get to the point maybe where you lose consciousness. I've seen pictures in the simulator of what guys did when this thing happened. And what it was they were fighting, and eventually they just slump, and they just kind of bouncing around. And as they start coming back to again, we called it doing the chicken, because you're just taut your head and your arms, and you're just kind of, and then that starts settling down after 20 or 30 seconds, and then you can fly again. And these guys at the end of it were totally exhausted. I mean, that apparently just drains all energy out of you.
Today they've got the auto, I can't remember what it's called, but it's auto collision avoidance, maybe it's called auto ground collision avoidance. And so it's saved a few guys even today in the F-16 community from flying into the ground following G-lock. It sounds like.
Yeah, I didn't have that on any of the planes I flew.
So having established then you've got this great radar, you have a fantastic weapons aiming computer and the ability to go and find targets and not worry too much about where you are because the airplane will keep track of that and get you in the right direction and onto the right timeline. What was the first couple of years of flying the F-16 like then? So how did, on the basis of that technological advancement, how did tactics evolve and what things led to that development?
We just got a lot more aggressive. For example, I was in the F-16 wing at Nellis. So we had down the street, we had the weapon schools, and we'd fly against the aggressors, we'd fly against the 15 weapon school, we'd fly against the 422 doing some of their tests. We got to do just a whole bunch of things that most units don't get to do. Now, in an F4, a 1v1, an F4 against an F5, that's a really tough fight for the F4. Because the F5's got better turn rate and better turn radius, and the F4's got to try to keep its speed up and do these big vertical maneuvers and keep sight of this little guy all while you're doing it. And it was a real difficult thing to even come out neutral, and most of the time you lost. In the F-16, we just enjoyed the payback. Okay. One, we had the newest airplanes there. They even smelled new, Steve. I went to pick one up at the factory, and I mean, it smelled like a new car.
Did it?
They were all 378, 379, 380, 381, 382, 383, 384. They're all in numerical order. They're brand new. They're the sexiest looking things I'd ever seen in my life, except for a few girls, maybe. But we'd go down the street and do a 1v1 against the F5s, and it was just the roles were totally reversed. We just owned them. It had to be at least 2v1 to be anywhere near challenging, and really 3v1 was probably an equal fight.
Okay, so before you go any further, how on earth do you do a 3v1? You so you've got there's one of you, there's three little F5s swirling around. How do you do
Yeah.
that?
Well, first of all, if you start with a 2v4 and one of them aborts and one of you aborts, so that ends up 3v1. So this one, we go into the fight. I've got all three of them on radar. I come down quick and I kill the trailing guy right there. So now it's 2v1. it takes about 180 degrees a turn for me to kill the second guy. The third guy's now maneuvering back towards the stern. You extend out of the fight. I was like 4 miles out of this fight. And I put it in slowable ACM, bring it around the corner. It locks him up. I shoot an AIM-9, and then I go in and I gun. And in the debrief, because this was an aggressor upgrade, the guy goes through the thing and he says, and it's not a bad statement to make. He said, you got the first kill. That was good. You got the second kill. And you'd extended out of the fight and were safe. He says, it might have been just good just to keep on going. You've got two kills and not risk your airplane coming back into a fight with a guy that's at your 6 o'clock, even at 4 miles. And I said, hold it. I said, 3v1, you might have a slight advantage. 2v1, I've definitely got an advantage. 1v1, I own the fight. I am not going to let you get away. I'm going to hunt you down and kill you. And that was just the mindset that you could do with that little thing, not because you were a great fighter pilot, but because you were flying a great fighter.
What about then the development of sort of, let's say, flight tactics? So, you know, two ship, four ship. The Eagle famously has the 8-ship wall of Eagles that, you know, it goes out there, line abreast, and covers all this airspace in the same fashion as you were talking about earlier around you and your wingman. What was the development then, or the exploitation of that radar capability times four, you know, with four F-16s or a flight of four?
Same type of thing. Basically, a flight of four is two flights of two. A flight of eight is two flights of four, which is each two flights of two. So you're going out together and you've got mutual support. You've got certain tasks you want to perform. But when things start breaking down, you're breaking down into two ships doing the job. That was the same way in the F-4 as it was in the F-16, but the F-16 was just so much better at it. You know, the radar lock-all modes were so much better. This all in a sort of visual fight. Now, if you're starting out at 30 miles and you're flying against Eagles with AIM-7s with NCTR, then eventually when you get into this, you're going to have to do two types of defensive maneuvers. If you think you're targeted, you're going to have to try to notch their radar. Put it on the notch where it can no longer determine what's you and what's ground, because your closing velocity on you is the same as the ground. Hopefully that's it. And I would typically do a little bit of weave there just to make sure I was in the notch. Eventually then, as they're getting in closer, you're going to do infrared missile defense. So you're going to have to come to idle and turn into and break into him. And as soon as you're inside the range for that and out of his gun plane, then you can start getting back and you can maneuver. And that was a tough thing to do, but it was possible to do. You could defeat an Eagle, AIM-7, AIM-9, and a gun, and win it. But he had the advantage in that arena, definitely.
Was it visual
arena, the F-16 had it, but in the all aspect arena, out of long range, the Eagle had it.
So would it, Ted, have been at around this time then that the again, I think the F-16 is well known for it, but the exploding cantaloupe. This idea of a four-ship of F-16s coming at a bunch of Eagles, and then you all split in different directions and, you know, up, down, left, and right. Did that come around about that time?
I never had it with eight airplanes. I never even had it dissimilar. We did fly 1v1v1v1s where you would have different ways to split up. Sometimes you would take the four-ship straight up in the air. Four would roll, he'd go that way, one go that way, the wing would peel off and go that way. You'd come around as you passed, the fight was on. Everybody was a friend and everybody was an enemy. That did have some good learning objectives to it, but the generals and things, when they learned about it, they didn't really care for it and they put an end to it. So I never even flew that in the F-16. That was mostly F-4 stuff. Late 70s, early 80s.
Was this part of the culture of zero tolerance around aircraft losses then? You lost an aircraft, and if you were a wing commander, you'd lose your job regardless of why?
Well, I don't know if it was really zero tolerance, but I remember, well, in some cases it might have been. We lost a lot of F-16s early on. when you go to a quantum leap like that with fly-by-wire and stuff, there's a lot of things that go wrong that you didn't expect. For example, there was a guy up at Hill was coming back from the range to Hill. He's crossing the Great Salt Lake. He hits a pelican, which takes off maybe part or all of his radome. But the radome had the two angle of attack sensors on it. And when the airplane didn't have the angle of attack sensors, it thought it was stalling and it pushed him over into the water. He got out right before it hit the water, but, you know, I don't think anybody had ever thought of that. We had, like I said, we lost a bunch of them for a couple of them for the emergency power units overspeeding. We had, and Hill lost their wing commander over one of those. Down at Nellis, we lost one guy between Christmas and New Year's one year when we weren't supposed to be flying, out of control in an air-to-air arena. I think the wing commander survived that one. But the next one, we had a plane run off the end of the runway because of some funny stuff. And I think he got fired over that. And I spoke with him about it because this guy was a great guy, a great wing commander. Everybody loved him. He was a great fighter pilot. He went to the range with you. You had to be careful. He was going to take your money. And he said what the four-star had told him was, he says, you know, it's like playing blackjack down in Vegas. You're getting good cards, but the dealer's just beating you. What do? You change tables. He says, that's what I'm doing. I'm changing tables. So, wow. Yeah, I don't know if it's one, but certainly by two. Typically the wing commander or the DO or both were gone. Wow. And a lot of good people got wrapped up in that shouldn't have been. Let me tell you about this one story about this guy that goes off the end of the runway. Because this shows how things occur in a new airplane that you just don't anticipate. Guy's coming back, he comes in to land, and he drops the gear, and he gets no gear down indication at all. So he goes out, declares an emergency, goes out, and he does an alternate gear extension. He still has no gear indication. Does a flyby above the tower. They say the gear looks down and locked. Says, okay. So he comes in to land, and sure enough, the gear is down, but he steps on the brakes, and he's got no brakes. So we had channel one and channel two. He goes to channel two brakes. He goes in, no brakes. Next procedure is to turn off the anti-skid. He turns the anti-skid on. He's still got no brakes. Not to worry. He's got a back 12 barrier coming up. He drops the hook to catch the back 12 barrier. Here comes the barrier. There goes the barrier. He's at idle, but he's still doing like 60 or 80 knots. He goes off the end of the runway, into the desert, bounces around, flips upside down. The airplane breaks in half. He tries to radio tower to let him know things aren't going well, but the battery is in the right gear well, which has broken off of the airplane, and there's a fire starting in the wing root out there. And since he declared an emergency, he had fire trucks lined up all along the runway, so they all follow him off the end of the runway. This guy's in there hanging upside down with no approved method of cutting through this canopy, and this fire guy says to him, lean back, son, I'm coming through. And he's got this diamond tip circular drill, and he cuts this big hole out of the side of this F-16 canopy. And Kim is getting ready to try to let himself down. He says, the fire guy just reaches in, unhooks his lap belt. He falls on his head. The guy grabs him by the harness, and he's trying to pull him out, and his head's caught, his helmet's caught. But they get him out, and he's okay. And what they find out was that there was one cannon plug that connected that one panel to the airplane. And if that cannon plug came loose, you lost everything there.
That was a cannon plug for the control panel for the gear? Or for the battery?
For the brakes, for the anti-skid, for the tail hook.
Wow. I have a vague recollection of going back to the leading edge flap failure, torque bar failure you referenced. I have a vague recollection of that video being on YouTube, actually. So it happened to somebody, and he managed to land the aeroplane. You can see him going in. He's all sort of skewed to one side, I guess, where you know, there's a bunch of drag on one side and none on the other. And I think he managed to land that. But yeah, it's interesting. Those are the sorts of things that you only find out by flying. What did you do then in terms of execution of mission? So you've talked about becoming more aggressive. You've talked about in the F4, you know, you would have not much of a chance if you were bounced, and it would mess up all of your calculations around sort of where you were and getting time on target. But I suppose one of the things I think about with the F-16 is if you're going to go and do an air-to-ground mission, I'm guessing in those days you'd have been carrying, you know, Mark 82, Mark 84, maybe some CBU, you'd have been heavy. If you're going to be aggressive going to the target then and you get bounced and you're heavy, can you still fight, or are you going to have to jettison those weapons in order to take out the bouncer?
Let's jump to the Lousy Mouth Bomb Competition, 1981. The Hill Wing, 388th Wing, takes a bunch of airplanes over there. It's an international competition. First time the F-16s had ever been there, but they have Buccaneers and they have Harriers and they have this and they have that, F-111s. And it's a big competition, lasts 3 weeks or a month or something like that. And the objective is for the bombers to fly this low level and get to the target. They've got air assets there out against them, maybe even ground assets out against them. I forget exactly what it was. But the airborne aggressors are going to try to bounce them and keep them from getting to their targets or make them get to their targets late. Well, for everyone except the F-16s, the objective is, let's see if we can neutralize them. We'll pass as head on to them as we can. We'll try to outrun them. We'll get to what we're doing. I think the unit that actually shot down the highest number of aggressors, not an F-16 unit, was like they killed one or two of the guys during this couple-week-long competition. The F-16 guys went out. They had TERS with BDU-33s, which were 33-pound bombs. And they went out and they killed in this week something like 75 or 80 of these aggressors. They basically just adopted the old adage that the best defense is a strong offense. They said, if they're coming into our airspace, we'll kill them and then we'll go to the target. So as I recall, the target things were like plus or minus 2 minutes. They planned on being a minute and a half early, still within their 2 minute time slot. But it gave them then 3.5 minutes to maneuver if they had to kill these guys. And so they'd go out, the aggressors would come in, the F-16s would pop up, they'd just kill them. And if I'm not mistaken, they were killing them with AIM-9Js and a gun, so they didn't have an all-aspect missile. I might be wrong with that, but that, I remember seeing a picture of one of their planes that had an AIM-9J on it. And the aggressors would come back in the debrief, and they would say, yes, but if you had Mark 82s or Mark 84s on board, that extra weight and drag, you wouldn't be able to do that. And the 16 guys said, yeah, we probably would. We just have to use burner. The aggressor guys thought they'd been using burner all the time, and they'd just been using mill power. So you still have capability, but there is a limit to the capability. And that was with a fourth-generation airplane against third-generation aggressors. You know, now when you're talking about fourth-generation airplane against fourth-generation aggressors, or worst case, fourth generation airplane against fifth generation aggressors, now that all changes. But when you've got the fourth generation plane and they don't, you can do things like that.
Talk a bit about the aggressors then. So you've talked about clubbing those three F5s and obviously the guys going out to Lossie having some success there as well. But did they then change the way that they were operating in order to up the game for you? Because the idea behind the aggressors was obviously to sort of emulate the threat, you know, typically let's say the Russians, but other nations too. But they weren't constrained to only their tactics. They were also there to try and, I suppose, you know, show you what a really capable adversary would look like, even if, you know, it wasn't that realistic. So did they start changing the way they did business in order to keep you guys on your toes?
They did some. They quickly learned what we could do, and they trying to come up with ways to hide guys or do high-low splits or do drags or things like that, try to notch our radar too, to try to get a guy into the fight unobserved. They, you know, typically they were emulating fish beds and floggers. So a fish bed's a very maneuverable airplane, but doesn't have a lot of all-aspect weapons. The flogger had some all aspect weapons, but was not maneuverable at all. But the aggressors, you know, as fighter pilots don't want to lose, they didn't want to lose either. So they started emulating what we called flog beds, which was the maneuverability of a MiG-21 with the apex missile system of a flogger. So, yeah, they adapted some. They tried to do, you know, what they could to keep things real.
You went to the Red Eagles. We've already talked about that. And you became eventually the high time MiG-23 guy on that squadron. But first you flew the MiG-21. So coming from that F-16A and going to the MiG-21, and this would have been, I guess, the F-13, the CE, Fishbed CE, or I don't know if you flew the J-7s, I don't know if you flew the Chinese ones, but what did you therefore do, knowing how capable the F-16A was, to sort of figure out how to beat that in a MiG-21? Because people talk about the low-speed capability, particularly of those Fishbed CEs, nose-pointing ability. That is counter to, I guess, a 25-degree angle of attack limit that you had in the F-16. How would you beat an F-16 in a Fishbed CE?
As maneuverable as that F-16 was, at slow speed, that MiG-21 was better. Especially that Fishbed C model, because it didn't have really much weight in the nose. It only had that high fixed radar, which is a range only radar. So what we'd do with them, even if they started offensive against us, we'd just wind that turn up. And that delta wing MiG-21 bled airspeed faster than any airplane you've ever been in your life. If you started going north at 450 and put it into a 6.5 G turn, by the time you were through west, it was at 350, through south at 250, through east, you were 150 knots, and then you could jack the nose up and fly it like a kite easily at 90 knots. F-16, as I recall, you know, 100, 105 knots, something like that. So, and the MiG-21, we had the big test pilot airspeed indicators in them that read, they went around once for every 100 knots, and then there was a number in the center that read what the 100 was. So you could fly, as I recall, our MiG-21 stalled between 77 and 72 knots, depending on how much gas you had in them. So, and if the airplane stalled, the only thing that happened was the nose dropped and rolled off on a wing. By that time, you had 110 knots again, and you could bring the nose back up. So what we did against all those airplanes that thought they had a very good slow speed capability was we'd just wrap that turn up, jack the nose up, fly it like a kite. Typically, they had overshot just a little bit, and might still be slowly behind us, but they could see themselves slowly walking forward on this. And we could just talk to them on the radio. How's this looking to you? He says, it's not looking very good. Yeah, let's knock it off. So that taught them that they needed to maintain some space between them and this thing, that they couldn't just go right for guns.
Did you have a chance to fly against Constant Peg or to be exposed to the Constant Peg program before you went to the Red Eagles to be part of it?
Yeah.
So had you learned that already then? I guess what I'm asking is, was the understanding or the level of sophistication around a performance profile or an exposure in 1981 mature enough to really teach a new F-16, because the F-16 is new, to teach a new F-16 guy what he should or should not do?
Yeah, because the 4477th guys would tell you this in the briefing. This wasn't something, the Constant Peg program wasn't something to just go out there and trial and error it. They would tell you, because they had flown against F-16s from the 422, who had them before a lot of other people had them and stuff. They knew what the airplane could do, and they knew what they could do. And so they would tell you in the briefing. Typically, we'd have, when DETS would come in, you'd get a security in brief, you get a local area briefing, then you get an hour on the MiG-21 and an hour on MiG-23. And the hour on the MiG-21 wasn't telling you what the plane could do based on what intel said. Everybody knew what the intel numbers were. We would tell them, or they would tell us, depending on which side we were flying on, what the plane could do well, what we liked to do with it and why, and what it could do but didn't do very well and why we didn't like to do that with it. So the 4477 guys, when I flew with them and my group, they told us all, you know, this is your strength. This is how you beat it. This is how you're going to lose to it. If you get too tight and he jams you, this is how it's going to turn out. But they also kind of said, if you feel the need to see this firsthand, do it now. You know, so you can see how this is. And so you typically get two or three engagements with the MiG-21. So you could try one of them where you got in tight and saw, and then you could try the other ones where you maintained some more spacing on them, kept a little bit more away from
them. I'm going to just, I suppose, demonstrate my ignorance here. But so if the MiG-21 then is really going to intimidate by sort of nose pointing, by pointing its nose at you wherever you are in the circle, how do you beat it?
Oh, well, you stay away. As he's winding this turn up, you kind of lag it out a little bit to maintain some spacing so that you can get some turn radius and come back in and shoot him with a missile, or maintain enough spacing that you can come back in and get your nose on him outside of 1,500 feet for gun range. You're probably going to be closing on him, but if he's doing 90 knots and you're doing 105, you're not closing real fast. You've just got to have enough spacing to allow that to happen. Now, this is all just a 1v1 visual fight where no one's really going to die at the end of it. If you start adding in tactics for the MiG-21, the MiG-21's probably going to try to stay fast too, as long as he can, and only wind that up to keep himself from dying. But if there's another airplane, another friendly airplane out there, and this MiG-21's sitting there at 80 knots or something, I mean, he's a strafe target. So.
And why would the MiG-21 stay fast as part of his tactics?
Well, because he doesn't necessarily want to get in that slow speed fight anyway if there's more than one airplane. If there's just the one airplane, he'll want to get you slow because that's where he's got the advantage. But if there's like two or three or four MiG-21s and two or three or four F-16s or F-4s or F-15s or whatever, everyone wants to stay fast. Speed is the potential to maneuver. And so that gives you maneuverability. When you're slow, you don't have much maneuverability.
You did end up on MiG-23, as I just mentioned, and obviously became the high time guy there. Cheeky question for you. Were you the high time or the most saucy guy in the Air Force or just in your unit on the MiG-23? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. I suspect in the Air Force, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. What did flying that then do for your or to your fighter pilot senses then? So you've come from this 9G highly maneuverable airplane, then you've flown this little sort of whippersnapper of a fighter in the MiG-21, and now you've gone to the MiG-23. What did that do to you? Say again.
It humbled you. I mean, your ego went away a good bit. Once again, it was good to show the guys the real airplane in the air, just to let them fly beside of it and look at it, what its real size was, what it really looked like, and things like that, the different wing sweep configurations and things. And then a lot in the engagements to try to show them the strength of the MiG-23. For example, you get in a fight maybe where the MiG-23 was offensive, this guy was defensive, he puts a good hard turn on you, you maybe try to take a snapshot or something like that, then you just unload and accelerate. He reverses to come back on you, and when he comes back on you, you've been lit the burner, pulled the wings to 72 degrees, rolled to keep him in the periscope, and you just say to him, when you get locked, give me your range and overtake. And it wasn't at all uncommon for him to say, 2.6 miles opening at 390 knots. And a missile's not going to catch that. So that was one of the things we just showed him was, if he tries to separate from the fight, he may be able to do that. The other thing that was kind of interesting was, typically in an intercept, when you're doing intercept against similar airplanes or even dissimilar airplanes, they're coming down the scope. Maybe you've each got 500 knots Cal or something like that, and you put the axe symbols on the guy and you lock him up, and the radar, when you lock it, goes into a little scan looking for it, and then it locks it up. Well, when they were doing intercepts against us with maybe a MiG-21 and a MiG-23, the MiG-21 was the slowest of the two, and he's coming in at 600 or 6 1/4, and the MiG-23 is coming in at 700 plus. So a lot of the guys, 15s and 16s, they put the axe symbols on it, and they try to lock, and by the time the radar got to locking him, he had flown out of the axe symbols down the bottom. So now the radar goes back to search, and now instead of him being 25 miles, he's 20 miles. And if they tried that again and didn't work, then it was 15 miles. So what the lesson learned there was, put him at the top of the axe symbols. So if he's going real fast, let him fly into the gate and not out of it.
Yeah.
So there were some lessons that could be learned there. And there were some things of altitude splits and things in energy. Like if you had that thing going 700 knots, and we did what we called astro hog, which was took it up in a big loop with the wings at 72 degrees. If you started at 15,000 feet, you came over the top at 35,000 feet. So a lot of other airplanes could do their Immelmann with you, but now they're below you. You know, they didn't start with as much energy as you had. So there were a few lessons learned that they could get in there, but most of the guys, certainly all the fourth generation fighters, just ate a MiG-23. I don't think I ever got a valid shot on a fourth generation fighter the whole time I was flying it.
You were simulating AA-8, the AFID, or was it Apex? I can't remember which one it is.
Well, Apex and AFID. Okay. Apex was the radar missile. AA-7 Apex was it, and the AA-8 was their AFID.
Okay, that was the IR. Was it the IR?
Yeah. AFID was IR. AA-8. Fights on, once they put the turn on you, things, I might have got a few snapshots, but that was probably about it. I think I got a couple valid shots on a couple F4s, but that was about it.
You then went to Hill, I think you said, to be an instructor at the RTU.
Luke.
Okay, you went to Luke. Was that a natural place to send somebody with the experience that you had just gained? I mean, I would have thought somebody with your experience would want to send to a frontline unit where, because I'm guessing you couldn't say too much. I mean, those guys going through the RTU wouldn't have been read into constant peg at that point, presumably. And so were you somewhat hamstrung in what you could do to share the knowledge?
For sharing the knowledge, like down in Luke, what I would do was when we'd start talking about MiG-21s and MiG-23s, and this was just about the time, you know, MiG-29s were just starting to come into the inventory. We didn't know a whole lot about them just yet. I've heard that if you do this against the MiG-21, this will happen. I've read somewhere if you did this, MiG-23 would do this. So that's how you could impart knowledge to the other guys in the thing. I ended up at Luke primarily, I think, because my wife at the time had a job in Las Vegas, and they had a company down in Phoenix, and so she could transfer directly to that company. And she'd been doing real well, and I didn't want to take her out of her element that much. So Luke ended up being a fairly good fix for us. I think the Air Force would have preferred me to have gone to another unit because they didn't want somebody going to be an RTU IP that hadn't been current in that airplane before they got there. So I had to go to MacDill to go through a TX Track 3 Bravo or whatever it was, and then back to Luke as an instructor. But it was no real problem for me.
Was it a bit of a culture shock, or was it similar to going from the F4 to the F-16A, going from the MiG-23 to the F-16C?
Oh, it was very enjoyable again. You know, once again, it had new avionics in it. We had Block 25 hardware with Block 30E software, as I recall. And like I mentioned in the one other thing, the radar in the F-16C, it had three levels in it. The first one, when you first started the engine and the radar came online, it came online in level one. And I think it only had about four frequencies that it frequency hopped around against. And I really don't know much about it, remember much about it, because we never used it. We always used level two. To get to level two, you had to put a code into the computer, but they gave us the code so everyone knew it. And everyone used it, even the foreign nationals. And that was the one that had hundreds or thousands of frequencies, whatever it used to frequency hop. And it had the RAID cluster resolutions and the non-cooperative target recognition. And it had all the bells and whistles on it. And then there was the wartime mode, which was level three, which you had to put a different code in to get to, and they didn't give us that code. When we asked them about it, said, how do you expect people to go to war with a radar that they've never used? They basically said they didn't want the Soviets in their Winnebagoes with 20 antennas sticking out of them running up and down the Reno Tonopah Highway, sucking up electrons, knowing what the radar could do. So I never flew the radar in level three. Don't know anyone that ever flew it. Never heard of anyone. I'm sure the AFETEK guys and the 422 maybe did at places where maybe they figured the Soviets couldn't suck up those electrons, but I never did.
Did they tell you what it could do in level three?
I think there was one briefing that we got on it, but a lot of the briefing was, it's pretty intuitive. It will do its magic. You will be the recipient. And that was about it.
When you say you had to put a code in the computer, do you mean sort of through the data transfer module? Was that part of your mission planning process, or rather than a manual entry in the cockpit?
It was a manual entry in the cockpit.
Oh.
One of the multifunction displays, when you called up radar, there was a thing for code and you punched it in. And it was to get to level two, it was just a four-digit code. And you punched it in and the radar popped up in level two.
And it was never changed then, the code.
No, I think that, they didn't care that people knew what the radar could do in level two. That was all the red flags and everything that we operated in, all the things against the aggressors, the 422, all this, that was all done in level two.
Did you think it was realistic that these Russians in their Winnebagoes would be going round? Do you think it was precautionary, or because I guess when you were in the Red Eagles, you must have been exposed to some of, what the intelligence agencies knew about the Russian intelligence gathering in the Nevada and Tess ranges.
Yeah, we saw it was perfectly legal. They had to register and things like that, but they could go anywhere they wanted. That was not a restricted area, and so they had these Winnebagoes with antennas sticking out of them, running around the Nellis ranges and I assume probably around most of the other ranges with fire bases, seeing what type of electrons were out there.
How was that legal? That wouldn't be legal
It's
today. That's.
an agreement that the United States has with Russia. We could do that on about the same level over there. And we sucked up electronic intelligence over there.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, I knew about is it the BRICSmith? I can't remember what it's called. There was the sort of East and West Germany thing where, you could go. Certain people could go and sort of observe what was happening in East Germany, and they could send people over to West Germany. But I didn't realize that that was happening on the ground in the United States with
Yeah,
Russian
they had certain
operatives.
reciprocal agreements. There were limitations on them and stuff, but we would let them do stuff here and we would do stuff there, and we wouldn't arrest their spies and they wouldn't arrest ours. And
Wow, that's incredible. So I suppose then it was a valid concern. So
yeah.
it was a real thing. What
Yeah.
about then at that point? Did you have AMRAAM in 88? So I think sort of 91 maybe was when AMRAAM came in, because I think that's when the F-15s got it first, and they were the first recipients of it, I think. But
We,
were you aware of AMRAAM coming down the pipeline to you?
oh yeah, we had AMRAAM software was in the airplane. We could load simulated AMRAAMs in the stores management computer, but it wouldn't sense the missile, and so it wouldn't give you any of the symbologies and stuff that would come up with it. I went actually in like 83 or 84 when I was still the chief of wing weapons. In the 474th F-16 wing, me and one guy from the 422 and one guy from Edwards went down to Carswell with General Dynamics, and we did the missile launch envelope validation testing studies, taking a look at how the proposal was to give the symbology for the missile launch envelopes for the AMRAAMs and things, and what the HUDs would look like. And for example, their HUD TD box at one time was just gobbledygook. It was a triangle with a probe leading out of it. There was the target speed. And there was an arc around the bottom, which was the launch envelope, even though the launch envelope was on the side. And we finally told him, we said, some things ought to be pure. A target designator box should do one thing, put it around the target. We've got the launch envelope someplace else. And the next morning they had that changed. So yeah, we knew AMRAAMs were out there and we knew they were coming.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it must have really peeved the F-15 guys off, but it was an F-16D model, I think 1992, that got the first AMRAAM kill against a MiG-25, maybe, Iraqi MiG-25. But what did you make of AMRAAM then in terms of how it would change the way you employed the F-16? I'm making the assumption that it would change the way you'd employ the F-16, because coming from what you've just described about being aggressive with AIM-9s,
Sure. It gave you the head-on, not only the head-on capability, because for an AIM-7, you have to maintain lock onto that target till the radar hits. You are illuminating that target. AMRAAM wasn't like that. It had its own active radar. It had anti-jamming features. It had, I think, some abilities to sort on its own to make sure it wasn't targeting a target that another AMRAAM in flight had from your airplane. Our symbology and stuff on the C model was set up for AMRAAM. So you could have your track while scan things and you could step through the targets. And all you need to do to pump four AMRAAMs at four separate targets was push the pickle button for the first target, step to the next target. Push on that one, step, push, step, push. And then when that radar went active, which I forget which range it went active at, if you shot it outside of that range, I think you needed to maintain talking to the missiles. But once it got inside of there, went active, you could leave the fight and the missiles were on their own. So yeah, that would have changed things significantly.
It's interesting watching you do that, because you're doing the HOTAS, which is shoot and step, because the step button's on the outside of the stick, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, step button's right there. Missile step.
Air refueling disconnect?
It was an air refueling disconnect.
And those will stay on, maybe.
And something else.
There'll be a bunch of F-16 aficionados watching this. They'll tell us in the comments. But
nose wheel steering. I think if you're on the ground with the gear down, that was your nose wheel steering button. Air refueling door open. It was air refuel disconnect and missile step in flight.
Yeah. You talked about the TMUS switch earlier, and there's that was in the F-16A, and then they introduced for the C model the DMUS switch, didn't they? The display management switch. How did you cope with that? It's been described as playing the piccolo, hasn't it? But how did you cope with
the
that?
Varsity. The A model was the piccolo. The C model was the varsity piccolo. You just learned it. You practiced it. So, yeah, you had the target management on the A. The C, you not only had target management, you had display management, and you also had countermeasures management for chaff, flares, ECM pod and stuff. And so that, it came down to practice. And that was, for us, some of the importance of getting to the range and from the range. We didn't just cruise to the range or from the range. We were doing exercises going out there. We're putting the radars in different modes. We're doing slowable ACM. We're doing vertical scan. We're using display management, rotating the displays around. That's where you got a lot of the practice on using these things, because, you know, that was just your right hand. And in your left hand, you had your radios, UHF, VHF. You had the missile cage uncaged. You had gun ranging. You had the cursor slew. There was just a whole bunch of things, but it was a lot easier than if you'd have to punched up here or gone down on a side panel. Hmm. So,
speaking of things that you had, one of the other things that I understand was a new thing for single seat fighters, at least, was the RAW. Didn't it have sort of digitized or synthetic sounds for each threat system? So an SA-2 would have a certain sound. An SA-3 would have a certain sound, SA-5 would have a different sound, and you could learn all those using a computer program on the ground. Is that true?
Not the way I remember it. In the early model RAW, radar homing warning, in the F-4, you were hearing raw audio coming in. So each system did have a different sound to it. But in the F-16 radar warning receiver, you typically got, unless you did something funny, you typically got what we called new guy audio, which meant when a new guy came on the scope, you got 7 beeps of new guy audio, just beep, 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 beep. And that was for you to look to the raw gear to see what else had come up on the scope. But there was a thing with the system test where if you held the system test button in, you could get wide open audio. You could get that pure audio coming in. And some guys, not me, some guys would go to the officers club at lunchtime and get a toothpick. And for their afternoon sorties, they'd go out and they'd take that raw gear. They'd push the button in. They'd jam the toothpick in beside of it and snap it off. And that would hold that raw gear button in so they'd get wide open audio instead of just the 7 beeps of new guy audio.
And would you, so that presumably then would indicate some old school guys. So you wouldn't, I mean, a new guy to the airplane wouldn't do that. So, but how would you know what you were listening to then?
From whatever came up on the scope.
Okay.
Because it would come up on the scope like as a 6 or a 3 or something like that, that showed you what threats were there. And as I recall, the one ring was the threat ring. So it showed when that system was in range, not necessarily how far you were away from it, but when that system was in range. So, you know, it wasn't an integrated system in that it was totally separate from the radar and the stores management. My understanding now, certainly of the fifth generation fighters, is that's all integrated to form one picture for them. But this was separate, and it was, you know, it just called your attention to the fact that you've got things looking at you that are threats to you, and these are what they are right now. And if one of them would launch, I think then you got launch audioed, and that one would flash.
So it wasn't as though by pressing that little button in, you would just hear a continuous stream of noise. You'd still hear discrete sounds, but they would be tied to what the radar warning receiver was processing.
Yeah, tied to the threats that were actually looking at you. If you had a search radar just go through you, you'd get beep, 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 beep,
yeah, okay.
Beep, beep. If a radar, like maybe a target, a search radar locked on you, might get a beep, and we got higher PRF preparing for missile launch, it might be, you know. So you're right. That was a lot of the older school F4 guys that kind of liked that wide open audio. But that was another audio thing that was competing for you. And sometimes the new guy audio wouldn't break through the radio chatter and things like that. So that's why I think a lot of guys, or at least some guys, did that.
Did you ever scare yourself in the airplane?
Which airplane?
F-16. Or I mean, any of them, really. I mean, I suppose I'm looking for a good story.
You know, the F-4, I had a student almost run us out of gas once, but that worked out fine. The F-16, it had a thing called deep stall. You ever heard of that?
Yeah, so the falling leaf, is that what it was?
It would stall, it would fall like a leaf, and the stabilator would be trying to get it out but wouldn't have enough, and there was a thing on your left side called manual pitch override, and you would rock it out like you were rocking a car out of the snow to get it out. I had that happen a couple times, but that was no real biggie. MiG-21 never scared me. MiG-23 scared me a couple times.
Do you remember them?
Yeah.
Can you tell us?
Well, there was the infamous day when I spun it twice, fighting 2 F-16s, kicked them across the tail and was going to do this reversal on them. And, you know, they were 2 miles away or something. Have you ever heard a thing called adverse yaw? Mm-hmm. Adverse yaw on the F-4. If you wanted to roll left, you'd put the left aileron, or the right aileron would go down, which would cause more lift on that wing, and it would roll left. But when you got it at a high enough angle of attack, that flap going down on that side caused more drag than it did lift. And so the airplane then would yaw to the right, which put this wing then get more lift than this one, and the airplane would actually roll left. So that was called adverse yaw. So I kick, you know, I'm bringing this MiG-23 back in a left turn, and it starts this gentle roll to the right. And it immediately brought back adverse yaw to me, and all you needed to do was unload the angle of attack, and it was good. Well, this thing did two converging barrel rolls, stopped in space, about 40 degrees nose high, yawed, threw me against the side of the canopy, and took off spinning. And one of these F-16 guys asked me, he says, "Are you okay?" I said, "No." But that gave me a lot of confidence, because if when you're task saturated, the first thing that goes is your hearing. It's called audio exclusion. You know, you're busy and you don't hear things. But I heard this guy and I said, "You know, you got this. You know what to do for it. Let's give it a shot." So I did the spin recovery procedure. And after about a spin or two, it popped right out about 70 degrees nose low. And I don't know what I am now. I'm maybe 15,000 feet or something. And I'm doing this recovery, which is going to be down about 12 or 13,000 AGL. And it's not a very aggressive recovery, but it's just a normal recovery. And when it's about 45 nose low, the nose pops to the horizon. Didn't fly there, popped there. So you knew the AOA was about 45 degrees and the flogger wasn't going to take that. And sure enough, it yawed, threw me against the side of camp again, flipped upside down, and started spinning upside down. But I had just had some very recent spin recovery experience in the MiG-23. So I said, "Let's give it another go." So I give it another go with the spin recovery procedure. And sure enough, it pops out 70 degrees nose low inverted. I roll it right side up. You know, I'm now down below 10,000 feet, but I can see the desert floor. And I just basically say, "Ted, do not let this airplane depart on you again." And I do a very gentle recovery for it, maybe clear the desert floor by 2,000 feet. The airfield's back there. I just do a gentle turn, said, "Sorry, guys, I got to take this one home," and went back and landed. And the funny thing was, I wasn't scared during that whole thing. I go back, I land, I'm rolling out. I've got it down probably at 60 knots, and then I get scared. I can just feel my heart and my chest pounding. And I went to the D-arm area, and I shut it down and got out and kicked the nose gear and hurt my foot and started hoofing it back to the squadron until Paco came out in the Jeep and picked me up and gave me a ride. But yeah, that was probably my worst experience in it. I had one other one where on an FCF, one of the ramps stuck doing about 1.7, and it started doing these uncommanded rolls. And to solve that, if it kept doing it, the only thing you could do was when the nose came up, when you were upright, you had to pull the nose up. And when you were inverted, you had to push. And you had to just get the nose up and up to get the speed down enough to where you could get the wings forward, to where the spoilers would work, to where you could counteract that roll caused by the yaw differential on that one engine intake. And but fortunately, after about a roll and a half, the ramp broke loose and went to its position, and that one worked out okay.
That sounds terrifying. That sounds more terrifying than the first one.
For a couple seconds it was, but you know, once again, you know what you're going to have to do. And if you can't do that, the only alternative is to shut the engine down to get it to go slow enough. Because as we've talked about before, if you're going faster than 1.5 Mach in an air model and you bring the throttle to idle, the burner will blow out, but the core engine still runs at 100% RPM until you get down below those speeds. And 100% RPM in a flogger with wings at 72 degrees, it doesn't slow down very fast at all. So, you know, I had some plans that I could do, but when you got a single engine airplane, you don't want to shut that thing down. That's the last thing you want to do. There was the one other time when the flogger saved my life, and I'm grateful for that. And that was a day when I was at 15,000 feet, and it was a ground model flogger, MiG-23BN flogger F. And I hit a bird right in the center of the windscreen doing about 630 knots cal. And that center windscreen on that ground model flogger had 17 layers of plastics and laminates. And that bird broke 14 of the 17 layers, shattered the windscreen, couldn't see out the front of that, came back, I think picked up a T-38, he did the approach to the runway with me on the wing, and in the flare he dropped me off and landed. So but I'm grateful that that I was in that ground model flogger that day.
Would you, are you comfortable, would you be comfortable talking about the other mishap that involved going too fast and not being able to slow the airplane down in time? You don't have to if you don't want to, but...
a little, if you want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to mention any names, but, you know, or any places or anything like that. But there was another MiG-23 loss that involved going too fast. I guess it'd be interesting to hear an explanation around the aerodynamic effects that that occur inside the inlets. You know, why it is that the Russians introduced that control lock to make sure that you couldn't, you know, retard you can retard the throttle, but the engine won't, as you just described, won't spool down until it hits certain metrics. Can you describe what took place in that flight, your understanding of it, and what the sort of aerodynamic phenomenons were that what were occurring?
Yeah. First of all, let me talk about that speed coast down interlock, because that is not unique to Russian engines. We got the same thing. Jet engines do not like to take air from high supersonic and take it to an idling engine at low subsonic. A lot of times it'll just tear the engine apart. So the same thing for ours, although I think ours, like an F-16 engine, which was the Pratt & Whitney F-100-200, I think it was 1.1 Mach, if I'm not mistaken. If you were above 1.1, you brought the throttle to idle, burner blew out, but the engine stayed at mil power until you got below 1.1, and then it rolled to idle. But it wasn't as noticeable, as dramatic as it was in the flogger being at 1.5 Mach. So this guy is on TR2. He doesn't have a lot of time in the airplane. He hasn't done a lot of academic preparation for it. The briefing for the flight was on the canopy rail. So he doesn't have a lot of background, a lot of system knowledge of things that can go wrong and what you do for him. So he's on TR2, which used to be a Mach run, taking the airplane out to about Mach 2.2 or 2.3. Limits 2.35, as I recall. And so he's taken it out on this, and he's got a T-38 in the chase plane. But at least in my opinion, the T-38 didn't chase him correctly. You don't chase a MiG-23 with a T-38 starting from line abreast and go burners ready now, because that MiG-23 is just going to walk away from it. The way I used to do it is I'd drop back 3 miles with the T-38. I'd just do a big angle of attack recovery, drop back 3 miles, do an in-place 180, which now put me 3 miles in front of him, call for the burners. You know, after a minute or so, he's going to be passing me, but I can still see him. And when he gets out to Mach 2, you know, he's 3 or 4 miles in front of me, and I can see him, but he's not 8 or 10 miles in front of me. So the T-38 guy loses sight of me. Then apparently what happens, from what I understand, the flogger, you have to understand, it kind of looked like an F-4. The intake ramps were the same as an F-4 and stuff, but it was a single-engine airplane. And what it was possible to do was get a compressor stall on half of the face of this compressor with the air backed up in one intake but not in the other, which caused so much drag on the face of the compressor that the plane yawed and rolled. MiG-23 flight controls. The wing, when it's forward, has full spoilers on the wings. Doesn't have ailerons. Rolls with spoilers. As the wing sweeps back, the spoilers have to fade out or they dig into the side of the fuselage, such that when the wings are all the way back at 72 degrees, there's no spoiler at all. It's rolling totally with differential stabilator, which under normal conditions felt absolutely normal. Rolled just like you would expect it to roll. But when you've got this stall in one side of the intake, one intake and one side of the compressor, which causes this roll, which causes this yaw, this roll, the stabilator doesn't have enough control authority to counteract that. So you've got to get something to counteract it. And the only thing they'll do is spoilers. So you've got to get the airplane slowed down enough that you can get the wings forward to get the spoilers to work into where they can stop this roll. And there's only two ways you can really do it. One is, because if you're going straight and level with a MiG-23 doing Mach 2, and you bring the throttle to idle, which means the burner blows out, but the engine stays at mill power, you're sitting there watching this, you're doing Mach 2. There's not enough airspace to get that thing to slow down to 1.5 for that speed coast down interlock to release the engine to let it roll to idle. So you either have to start jacking the nose up, and when it's rolling, when it's inverted, push, and when it's right side up, pull to get it to slow down to do that, or you got to shut the engine down to get that engine not producing thrust where you can get the wings forward, where you can stop the roll. And that would be challenging for a guy that's got 50 or 100 sorties in it. For a guy that's only had one sortie previous to this, it was just more than he probably didn't know what was happening or didn't know how to correct it if it was happening. So he ends up jumping out, and he dies in the injection.
Did you really, as part of your checkout, then your personal checkout in the aeroplane, did you really understand those things yourself as well before you let loose in the aeroplane?
Oh, yeah. We knew it even before it happened to him. It was a known factor. But certainly after it happened to this guy, then every guy that checked out the MiG-23 after that, that was part of the emergency procedure stuff that you'd go through and what you needed to do for it.
You said at the beginning that you were called Gabby in the 4477th. Where does that come from then?
Check out in the MiG-21. You flew. Let me go to total checkout, because this checkout was simple, but it was beautiful in its simplicity. You had about 2 weeks of academics, and then on Wednesday the second week, you went out with your IP and you just did an engine start. You started the engine, shut it down. He jumped in and went and flew a BFM mission. On Thursday of that second week, you did a slow taxi. So you got in and you started the engine. You'd done that once before. That's not new. But now you're going to taxi the airplane. And especially the early model MiG-21Cs, they didn't have nose gear steering. So getting it out of the chocks and into the chocks was some of the most challenging things you did. You had to get enough power to get the speed going enough, to get the turn going without stopping, because then you couldn't power up because you'd blow over the crew chiefs and the age equipment and stuff. So anyway, you taxi out, and your call sign is Zigzag 01. And so you taxi out, and your IP's chasing you in a Jeep, and you go down to the arming area, and they arm you up, and you go out on the runway, and you taxi down the length of the runway at taxi speed, which for us was about 70 knots. And the reason for that is MiG-23 brakes run off of air. It didn't have nose gear steering, so you steered it with differential brakes. Now, the F4 had a pneumatic system too, but it had a pump on it where if you used some of the air out of it, the pump replenished it up to the normal pressure, which I think was 2,000 PSI. MiG-21 didn't have that. You got a certain amount of air to use for that flight, and when that air was up, you were done. No more brakes. So as a result of that, MiG-21 guys watched their air pressure, pneumatic pressure, almost as closely as you watched your gas. But if you get it up over 50 knots, then you could steer it with the rudder, and you didn't use the brakes, and you weren't using any air. So once we'd get it up on a straightaway, we'd push it up to 50 to 70 knots, and we'd taxi at that speed till we needed to get it slowed down, then a slow, steady application, get it in the arm area, taxi it down the runway, de-arm it, take it back to the chocks. Friday of the second week, you did your fast taxi. So you started the engines. You'd done that twice before. You taxied the airplane out to the runway. You've done that once before. You take it out on the runway, but now you take it, you run the engine up, you release the brakes, you light the burner, you take it up to 135 knots, and then you abort it. Throttle idle, put the drag chute out, get it stabilized, take it to the end of the runway. All the generals used to ask us, why are you teaching a guy to do an emergency? Why are you teaching him abort? Well, we're not really doing that, sir. What we're trying to do is combine two of the more critical phases of flight into something this guy can do on the ground so that when he goes up on TR-1 and he has to do it for real, he's done it one time before. And those critical phases of flight are the takeoff roll, getting it up to 135, which is about nose wheel liftoff speed, and then the after landing portion after the guy lands, get throttled out of getting out the drag chute, getting it stabilized in there, and then getting it down to D-arm. So then on Tuesday of the next week, you had your TR-1 flight. So you started the engine. You've done that three times before. You're getting pretty good at that. You taxi to the end of the runway. You've done that twice before. That's not new. You take it out on the runway. The T-38 typically took off first. He would pull closed traffic, and then he would clear you for takeoff. Tower basically relinquished control to the T-38. That was done all the time. And when he was in position, he'd clear you for takeoff. You ran it up, released brakes, lit the burner, took it to 135 knots. You've done all that before. Now you just rotate the airplane to 10 to 12 degrees nose high. Gear comes up. You get airborne, the gear comes up. You get going a little faster. The flaps come up a little bit more. After that, you bring the gear handle back to neutral, which was the MiGs was one of their things to take hydraulic pressure off the system. The T-38's coming around behind you. He picks you up just as you break ground, and you go out and you fly your TR-1, and you do your hard turns and your loops and your acro and maybe a stall or something like that in the MiG-21. You didn't do a stall in the MiG-23, and you come back and do a couple touch and goes with your IP chasing, and you do a full stop. So that was TR-1. You did, I think, four of those, and then you did a check ride, and you're qualified in the airplane. But then we did a thing called performance profiles. And the first performance profile that you did with your IP, and then the next four you did against the fleet before you went into your BFM checkout. So I'm on performance profile 2 with this guy. Performance profile 1, you know, I led that, briefed it, and debriefed it, and went okay. There wasn't any big comments from the IP. So I go out on performance profile 2 against the fleet, and when the guys in the squadron weren't doing anything, they would turn the squadron radio to your frequency and listen to see what was going on, just so they could give you shit for nothing else. So I come back from that, and we used to have a thing called valet parking. Our fuel pit was just across from the squadron. We'd just pull the MiG into the fuel pit. The maintenance guys would fuel and push it back to the chocks, and you'd just go in the squadron. So I go in the squadron, and Monroe Watley's in there, and he goes, no. He says, you didn't talk to him enough. He says, you need to tell him about this. You need to tell him about that. You need to tell him about this other thing. I said, okay. So I go up on performance profile 3, and I tell him about those things that Monroe was saying. So I come back in. I said, okay, Monroe, how was that? And he says, now you're just being Gabby. So that's how that came about.
So final question for you then. So when we met the first time, I think we talked on the phone, but the first time I actually met you was 2016 for the Red Eagle reunion that we both went to. But you said to me that even though it had been about, I think at that point, 40 years since you'd last flown the F4, you still remembered the shutdown checklist off by heart. Do you still remember it now?
Mode 4, hold lower guard up, stab auxiliary gauge, turn winged up, normal engine, ice, normal radar, temperature off, stab trim set, rev system standby, rate move, P2 heat, IFF off, temperature default, full hot, full forward, tack and off, sight shutter standby, close, refueling selection, all tanks, formation lights off. I can't get rid of it.
That's crazy.
It's using space I could use for other things. I can't get rid of it. F-16 was much better. It was sleepy. Speed brakes, landing light, ejection seat, EPU, probe heat, IFF. Easy. But I don't know why I remember that. I flew many more hours and things in the Boeing 757 than I did in the F-4, and I can't remember the 757 checklists at all. But that F-4 checklist just stays with me.
Well, Ted, Gabby, thank you so much for joining us once again on 10% True. It's been great to speak to you again, and appreciate you sharing your experiences and your stories with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on, Steve.
Cheers, Ted. Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.